The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome back, everyone. So today we're tackling a really significant work, a classic of American sociology, actually, Habits of the Heart.
American individualism and commitment in American life. It's a big one.
It really is. And it's one of those books that kind of gave us the language, didn't it, to understand that feeling,
really?
You know, when you feel maybe successful, but also kind of unmoored, rootless.
Yeah, unmoored is a good word for it. And, you know, revisiting it, it feels, frankly, even more urgent now than it did back in the mid-80s when it was first published.
That's striking, isn't it? Why do you think that is?
Well, the authors were diagnosing this this cultural tension, this crisis, really, rooted in what they saw as an extreme form of individualism. And they argued it was weakening the social fabric, you know, the bonds that actually sustain a free society.
Right. So that's our focus today, exploring their central question. If everything revolves around the self, my fulfillment, my desires, my personal journey, what happens to our commitments to, you know, family, community, even the country?
And crucially, are we maybe sacrificing something deeper, like genuine meaning, in this constant chase for personal autonomy?
That's the core tension.
What's really fascinating, I think, is their point that this radical individualism isn't just, say, bad for society in the abstract. They argue it's actually detrimental to the individual, too. It kind of undermines the conditions for real happiness.
That's a paradox.
Exactly. This push and pull between freedom and belonging. It's like the deep story of American life, and this book offers a way to think about it, to maybe navigate it better. So maybe we should talk about the main architect behind this, Robert Bella. He was a major figure, a sociologist at UC Berkeley.
Right. And what made his approach distinctive? Because he wasn't just looking at data, was he?
No, not at all. Bella was deeply interested in the moral and spiritual dimensions of social life. He wasn't afraid to ask the big questions about meaning and values.
Well, he'd already made a name for himself with that essay, Civil Religion in America, years before. How does that connect here?
Oh, it connects directly. He was already thinking about the glue that holds a nation together beyond just laws and government. You know, the shared myths, the symbols, the common beliefs.
The civil religion.
Precisely. And he had this amazing background in world religions and history, so he could see that America's intense individualism wasn't entirely new, but maybe it was reaching a kind of dangerous extreme. He put it in a much broader context.
And we should definitely mention, this wasn't just Bella. It was a huge collaborative effort. Richard Matheson, William Sullivan, Ann Swidler, Stephen Tipton, a whole team.
Absolutely crucial, because they blended this really sweeping historical and philosophical analysis with something incredibly grounded. These deep qualitative interviews, hours spent talking to ordinary middle-class Americans about their lives.
So it wasn't just theory from an ivory tower.
Not at all.
Yeah.
They were listening to how people actually talked about their jobs, their marriages, their communities, their faith. They were trying to capture the real habits of the heart, as they put it, borrowing that phrase from Tocqueville.
Yeah.
That's what gives the book such weight, I think.
Okay, so let's lay out the core argument. Bella and the team basically say that American culture is dominated by this pervasive, radical individualism. It's become our default setting, our first language for understanding everything.
Yeah, the go-to explanation for why we do things.
And they identify two main flavors of this individualism, both problematic in their own ways. First, there's what they call utilitarian individualism.
Mm-hmm. That's the sort of pragmatic, self-interested view. Sees life, society is a big marketplace. Everyone's out for themselves, maximizing their own advantage. Think careerism, economic competition.
The bottom line mentality.
Pretty much. But then maybe even more influential today is expressive individualism.
Right. This one's more about feelings, authenticity, the therapeutic view, you could say.
Exactly. Life becomes this project of self-discovery, finding your true self, expressing your unique potential. Personal feelings are paramount. Emotional honesty is the highest virtue.
And you can see how these two might even conflict sometimes, right? The hard-nosed careerist versus the person prioritizing, say, emotional well-being above all else.
Definitely. But the author's main point, their diagnosis, is that both of these languages, because they're so focused on the self, make it really hard to justify commitment.
Well, why? How so?
Well, if everything is about my utility or my feelings, why would I stick with something, a marriage, a community project, a civic duty, when it gets difficult, when it demands sacrifice? This individualistic language just doesn't have a good answer for that.
It makes commitment seem optional. or maybe even irrational.
Kind of, yeah. It erodes those habits of the heart, the shared customs, the moral reflexes, the belief in something larger than ourselves that Tocqueville saw as essential for a free society to actually work.
But they don't just diagnose the problem. They do offer a path forward, a kind of solution.
They do. They call for reviving what they call the second languages that used to balance out individualism in American history, primarily biblical faith with its emphasis on covenant and community.
And civic republicanism.
Right. Which stresses virtue, public participation, and commitment to the common good. It's about finding that balance again.
Okay, let's get into the specifics, because the power of the book is really in the stories, the people they interview, they use these archetypes. Tell us about Brian Palmer.
Ah, Brian. Yeah, he's a really potent example. He's this successful manager, upwardly mobile, doing everything right according to the rules of utilitarian individualism, climbing the ladder, you know.
The American dream, basically.
Right. But he's deeply unsatisfied. Yeah. He feels this emptiness, this unarticulated longing, as they put it, for connection, for community, for meaning that goes beyond his career success and his possessions. He's got the success, but it feels hollow.
He embodies that paradox we talked about earlier.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
His success isolates him.
And then there's the impact on private life, on love and marriage. How does this expressive therapeutic mindset change things there?
Well, it tends to shift relationships away from being seen as, say, a covenant, a binding promise through thick and thin, towards something more like a contract for mutual benefit or a vehicle for personal growth.
So the relationship exists primarily to serve the emotional needs and self-actualization of the two individuals.
Largely, yes. And while that sounds appealing in some ways, focusing on growth and fulfillment, it makes the relationship incredibly fragile. What happens when it stops feeling fulfilling? Or when one person's growth seems to demand leaving?
The justification for staying, for sacrificing, becomes much weaker if the main goal is individual happiness.
Exactly. Self-sacrifice, which is arguably necessary for any deep, lasting bond, starts to look like a bad deal from the perspective of expressive individualism.
This focus on the private self, the inner voice, it reaches its peak in what's probably the most famous concept from the book, Sheilaism.
Oh, yes, Sheilaism. It's unforgettable. It came from an interview with a nurse, Sheila Larson.
What does she say?
When they asked her about her religious beliefs, her faith, she described it as just my own little voice. It's Sheilaism.
Wow.
Yeah. And she wasn't being cynical. She genuinely meant that her faith was something entirely personal, self-created, guided only by her inner feelings. No need for tradition, no need for a religious community, no external authority whatsoever, just Sheila.
That perfectly captures that radical privatization of meaning, doesn't it?
It's the ultimate endpoint of expressive individualism applied to spirituality. The self becomes the sole source and judge of truth. And you can see echoes of that Sheilaism everywhere today, not just in religion, but in how people approach values, morality, lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
It's all about personal preference, that inner voice.
So this privatization is really key. The authors look back at American history and identify these four moral traditions, the biblical one, the Republican one we mentioned, and then the utilitarian and expressive individualisms. And the story they tell is that the last two have basically pushed the first two out of the public square.
Yeah, they've become dominant, especially in how we think about major parts of life, like work.
How has work changed?
Well, think about the older ideas of work as a calling, something you do for God or for the community, or as a practice with its own inherent standards of good work. That's been largely replaced by the idea of work as a job or a career.
Meaning its main purpose is?
Its main purpose is instrumental. It's to make money, gain status, and fund your private life. The connection between your work and the common good gets really thin, sometimes invisible. It's about what the job does for me.
And the same shift happened with citizenship, they argue?
Definitely. The older civic Republican ideal was about active citizens deliberating together about what's best for the community. Now, politics is often seen as just this messy competition between special interest groups managed by professionals.
And the average person becomes more of a spectator, or maybe just a consumer of political news.
Exactly. A passive consumer, rather than an active participant shaping the public world.
Okay, so it's a pretty bleak picture in some ways. But they do offer hope. They talk about renewal, and it hinges on reconnecting with what they call practices and communities of memory. What do they mean by those?
Okay, so practices are things like, well, think of craftsmanship, or being a good teacher, or even good parenting. They're shared activities that have their own internal standards of excellence.
Meaning you do them well, not just for money or external rewards, but for the sake of doing them well.
Precisely. They require virtues, skills, commitment. They ground you in something real, something outside your own head, beyond just utility or fleeting feelings. They teach discipline and care.
And communities of memory.
These are groups, families, congregations, local communities, even the nation itself, that sustain their identity by telling stories about their past. They remember where they came from, what they stand for, and that shared narrative helps guide their future.
So it's about being rooted in a story larger than your own individual life.
Exactly. It's the antidote to that feeling of rootlessness that Brian Palmer experienced. It connects you to history, to shared purposes.
Let's pull out some of the big themes here. One that really struck me was what they called the impoverishment of moral language.
Oh, absolutely. This was a key finding from their interviews. They found lots of people who were living decent, committed lives, volunteering, being good neighbors, sacrificing for family, but when asked why they did these things,
they couldn't really explain it.
They struggled. They fell back on the language of personal choice or feeling, well, it just felt right, or it's what I chose to do. They lacked a shared public vocabulary to talk about things like duty, obligation, the common good, or even covenant.
And why does that matter if people are doing good things anyway?
It matters because if you can't articulate your values in a shared language, it's really hard to defend them, to pass them on, to build a public life around them. How do you teach the next generation about commitment if you can only describe it as a personal preference?
That makes sense. It becomes purely subjective.
Which ties into the second theme, the paradox of individual fulfillment. We touched on this, but it's worth underlining.
The idea that chasing personal fulfillment above all else is self-defeating.
Exactly. The book argues that when you approach relationships, work, community only asking, what's in it for me? Or how does this help my personal growth? You actually undermine the very things that create deep, lasting satisfaction.
Like trust, loyalty, self-sacrifice.
Right. Those require looking beyond the self. The ankiness that someone like Brian Palmer feels, despite his success, is Exhibit A for this paradox. Pure self-interest doesn't ultimately satisfy the human heart.
Which leads directly to their counterargument, the third theme, the social nature of the self. This is their direct hit against radical individualism.
Yeah, they state it so clearly. We find ourselves not independently of other people and institutions, but through them. We discover who we are face-to-face and side-by-side with others in work, love, and learning.
So identity isn't something you just discover locked away inside yourself.
No. It's forged in relationship, through commitment, through belonging to communities and traditions. We need others. We need institutions. We need shared purposes to become fully human. The isolated self is an illusion and a damaging one.
The book is full of really memorable lines that capture these ideas. Let's highlight a few key quotes.
Definitely. One that sums up the core dilemma is, individualism lies at the very core of American culture, but it may have grown cancerous, threatening the survival of freedom itself.
Wow, that's strong. The very thing we value most, freedom, individualism could destroy itself, taken to an extreme.
It's a powerful warning. And then, of course, there's Sheila's iconic line.
It's just my own little voice. It's Sheilaism.
Can't beat it for some of that radically private, self-invented approach to meaning. It just resonates, even decades later.
And I like this one, too, about why we need more than just private life. Without the public world, we turn toward private satisfactions, but these turn out to be insufficient.
Mm-hmm. It speaks to that need for connection, for purpose, beyond just our own comfort or pleasure. We're built for something more, and purely private life doesn't quite cut it.
Okay, so bringing this all together, how can we, you know, apply these insights? What are some practical takeaways for listeners?
Well, the book really encourages us to consciously use those second languages of commitment and community. So one application could be to rework your career narrative.
Meaning,
try to think about your work not just as a way to make money or climb a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Ask, how does what I do actually contribute something valuable? Is there a practice element to it? Are there standards of excellence beyond just profit? Connect it to a larger purpose if you can.
Okay, that's one. What else?
Second, strengthen mediating institutions. These are those face-to-face groups between the individual and the big state or market.
Like local clubs, congregations, volunteer groups, neighborhood associations.
Exactly. Don't just be a passive member or a consumer. Invest real time and energy. Show up. Participate. That's where you actually learn and practice the habits of cooperation and trust they talk about. It happens in person, not just online.
Good point. And a third application.
Maybe adopt a covenantal mindset in intimacy. Move beyond seeing marriage or deep friendships as just contracts for mutual benefit or therapy sessions.
Think of them more as promises, commitments intended to endure.
Right. Commitments that will inevitably require virtues like loyalty, forgiveness, and yes, sacrifice. Paradoxically, embracing that difficulty, that sense of covenant, is often what makes the relationship truly deep and strong for both people involved.
So as we wrap up, what's the lasting impact of Habits of the Heart for you?
For me, it's the power of the diagnosis. It gave us, and still gives us, such a clear framework for understanding this tension that runs through modern life, the pull between wanting freedom and autonomy and needing belonging and commitment. It helps explain so much of our cultural anxiety.
It really names the problem.
It does. And it also offers hope, reminding us that we have these other traditions, biblical faith, civic republicanism, that we can draw on for renewal. We don't have to be stuck in radical individualism.
My final thought is similar. It's that crucial idea that fulfillment and commitment aren't enemies. The book shows they can actually reinforce each other if we recover those traditions of commitment. It's not about choosing one over the other, but finding an integration. Honoring the individual, yes, but within frameworks of shared life and mutual obligation. That feels like the key.
Well said. It's about finding that balance.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.